Let's move from radio to television today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Fran Riley is a familiar face on Channel 6. We'll ask about his work today on Scribble. You have toiled long in the trenches, haven't you, Fran?
Rainstorms, snowstorms, tornadoes.
How would you describe your position in television today? A producer?
A feature reporter and kind of an economic reporter as well, a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I love telling human interest stories, and in a world that I think needs a lot of positivity, if that's such a word.
Well, it is such a word. My granddaughter just got an award for positivity at a conference out in L.A. for secretaries.
I'm off to a good start.
I didn't realize that was a word either, but you exude positivity, Fran.
Well, thank you very much.
Is that an act?
No. I hope not. But, you know, I tell people that I meet ordinary people who, in my opinion, do extraordinary things. One of my favorite shows as a kid growing up, you might remember the On the Road series with Charles Kuralt.
Enjoyed
that very much. And now the show that I really enjoy watching on Sunday mornings is the CBS Sunday Morning program, because so much of that is human interest and slice of life. And I just I find that very, very fascinating.
You know, Fran, we concentrate on writing and reading. And in your job, you have to do an awful lot of script preparation, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that, because as one whose hearing is not as acute as it should be, I depend on the closed captions. But it entertains me sometime in newscasts when the closed captions get ahead of the reporters or they start ad-libbing and you're not sure what's going to show up.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you work off of a teleprompter?
No, not when I'm out in the field. I do primarily the research, the writing of the stories, the interviewing. I do work with a tremendous group of photographers who really are experienced, and they get beautiful shots and different stories, and they make the story sing, and they make it come alive, you know. And do a lot of writing, Don, because of the fact that that's part of my job, and I've always enjoyed writing. After you've had Jesuit priests for 4 years in high school, you learn to
write.
You learn to like writing a little bit.
Well, that'll do it. But, you know, how has your position changed? You started in radio, you said.
Right. I started in radio at a small radio station in Lowell, Massachusetts, back in about 1973, and have been in broadcasting ever since. And in those days, the radio station signed on at sunrise and then signed off at sunset. So as we got closer to wintertime, they told me, you might want to consider finding a station that's on 24 hours a day, because we're going to be signing off at sunset and you're going to be out of a job. So.
Well, you know, that's true. I worked at one of those, KWPC in Muscatine.
Yes.
And I was advised to take a job there of the several offers I had. They said, because if you work at a station like that, you'll have to do everything and you can learn it all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most valuable 2 years I've spent in the business. Even though I went from there to television, that training was important.
Yes, yes.
How was the transition for you from radio to television?
Kind of different from the standpoint of your writing to pictures, you know, to a certain extent. And But I just did a lot of research and practiced a lot. When I was in college, I had instructors that drilled in us, especially when it came to delivery and using your voice, to practice, pick up a book or a newspaper and read out loud for 25 or 30 minutes a night and record yourself and listen to your voice, because they said if you continue to have that New England accent, you're probably not going to go very far, right, young man. But, you know, Don, in all seriousness, enrolled, I think we've lost a little bit of that. I don't know if anybody really works that much with reporters or people in the media on vocal variety and delivery and emphasis on certain words. I think so much of it now is tweets and likes on Facebook and shares that the business has changed quite a bit from the days that I started, yeah.
In those early days when I did some production work at Channel, it was then Channel 5, WOC-TV, first went on the air, the whole staff, everyone who appeared on the air, had to take voice lessons. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a shrewd move. That really is. It's just everyone can use voice lessons,
absolutely,
for sure.
But you no longer have to use a Midwestern accent, do you?
No, well, anymore. I had a Southern accent to dispose of.
But you don't have to dispose of it anymore. You could bring it right back.
Well, that's true, but it's interesting. It's all in listening to yourself, because when a teacher told me that a good speaker has neither a Southern nor a Northern accent, I said, what's a Northern accent? And she gave me something with these, dem, does, use, guys, and so on. But from that day, I never had a Southern accent. You just listen,
yes,
to yourself and you think, okay, that's not the way I'm supposed to sound.
And in New England, it's park the car and have it yard, right, is what we were told. So.
Law and order.
But how do you dig up stories? When you were at Channel 4, you were a reporter, and start there. Are you just given assignments, or do you have to dig up subjects yourself?
From what I'm doing now, Don, I dig up the stories myself. I will call people. I'll read newspapers. Business cards have been very, very handy tool for me, because when I go out on stories, I'll say to somebody, maybe there's somebody in your family or in your neighborhood or at your church that has an interesting hobby or does something that is worth telling the public about. And that's one way to get story ideas. I was telling Roald before we went on the air that probably one of the most time-consuming parts of my job is scheduling all this, because people need time to prepare, and you just can't call them up at noon and say, we'll be over at 1 o'clock to do the story, you know. And so I'm booking stories now into late November, early December. I like to keep a couple of months ahead of time, because sometimes people have things that come up in their own lives where they have to reschedule or whatever the case might be. So I try to stay on top of that. That's a very important aspect of the job.
I think you have a feeling, Fran, that everybody's got a story if you just dig enough.
I really do.
Because you've done how many now?
We've done probably, I'm just a ballpark guess, in excess of 700.
Yeah.
In the
whose idea was Fran's Features?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll try to make this story short. I had just gotten out of the hospital in 2011. I had had brain tumor surgery.
Right.
And I came back to work, and they said to me, would you enjoy doing some lighter side feature-type stories? And I jumped at the opportunity. And that's how it all started in 2011, and here we are 7 years later, and they haven't told me to leave yet. So.
Well, you are in some ways, given the nature of most news, a one-man counterculture, right? It was James I of England who first said, no news is good news, but you managed to find really good news.
Well, I like to emphasize the positive. You know, I think everybody I hear this so often, Don and Roald, from people. They'll say in this day and age, thank goodness for some positive news. And that's kind of, I think, where we are in this country to a great extent.
Except that it tends to be the negative news that sells.
Exactly.
Right? Well, that's exactly. Everybody says, I hate negative political ads, but they fall for them.
That's true.
And they vote for them.
By definition, news is the exception. And the exceptions are the explosions, the murders, the earthquakes, and so on. God help us if the news became another normal day, nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, then if good things are the exception, then we're in real trouble.
Yes.
So the news is always going to be the exceptional. And doing a feature like Fran's feature, that's just a little salve on what is really going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But don't you ever get into the sadder aspects of life, Fran?
I do. I've covered so much of that over the 40 years of doing this. And, you know, I'll give you one example of a story that I'll never get an opportunity to cover again. You may recall the story earlier this summer where the World War II Army veteran had been missing in action since the 1940s. And through DNA evidence, they were able to recover his body and bring it back to Little Morning Sun, Iowa, where he was buried with full military rights. And that's closure for the family, but a little bit of sadness at the same time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no desire anymore to cover drive-by shootings or drug raids and things like that. I've paid my dues with regard to that.
Isn't it kind of fatiguing to be in that business?
Very fatiguing, Don. Yeah, I go home now at night. I tell my wife, and this is the honest to goodness truth, in such a better frame of mind role because I've been around positive all day long, you know. So,
well, you're way ahead of us. We're positively scrambling for information on this program. But, you know, that was interesting that it was the station's approach to you rather than your own idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wonder what occasioned that. They were just looking for something to leaven the quality of news? Or
I think that they felt that to a certain extent there was a need to have these kind of stories told to the public. And I'm forever grateful for that because the people that I've had the opportunity to meet in the last 7 years have been remarkable. This man sitting to my right was one feature that we did. And, Don, we did a feature on you.
Yes, I've been trying to live that down ever since.
So has doing the program changed you in any way, or did you find what you thought you would find when you started getting closer to people?
At first, I thought to myself, now, how am I going to come up with a story 5 days a week, and what are they going to be about? But, boy, you start talking to people, and Roland, I think you and I talked about this earlier, everybody seems to have a story, you know?
Yeah,
some nicer than others.
Right. But, you know, there are stories you occasionally do that could turn into ridicule, and you never do that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you approach it with, I guess, positivity is a good word.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to know that you're still learning vocabulary, Trey.
Right? It is. Well.
But now comes the question. You've accumulated all. Do you have scripts for all the shows you've done?
They're somewhere. They're out in the archives there somewhere, but I don't have them personally, no, Don. I do have copies of some stories that I've done, the video.
Well, Roll, now's your time to make your pitch.
Right. Well, you ought to put them together. And, you know, a video or something.
Come on. They don't do CDs.
Well, a book, yeah. But I think they wouldn't be the same stories if Fran put them in a book. It's Fran's enthusiasm, I think, that it really is a great part of the show.
Are you telling me that he cannot translate his feelings into literature, into writing? Come on. You're the writing instructor. You know, would you tell someone that, well, you got to do this in video?
I can't imagine it there without Fran's voice.
Well,
I mean, it's so much a part of the program and the enthusiasm and the discussion afterwards that you sometimes have with the other reporters about what an interesting thing this was. What intrigues me is you always seem to have a kind of a way in and a way out, a clincher, a little phrase. When do those come to you?
Sometimes when I'm writing the story, or when I'm out in the field at times, I'll jot things down in my notebook and maybe refer to that later on, because just having turned 65, my memory isn't what it used to be.
But you seem to find just the right line to the way to end the program.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Well, that's finding the right line, opening and closing, is, I think, sometimes it seems like 50% of the whole project, the way in and the way out. And then the body kind of takes care of itself.
The way I used to do it was to take a 3-mile walk, which I can't do anymore. But, you know, I would get stuck. I knew what the subject was, but there wasn't a way in. And I would just walk and think about anything but the writing. And by the time I got back to campus, you know, sometimes the phrase was there. Mm-hmm. Quite often it was there. Mm-hmm. But you listen for something that somebody says that's just the perfect way of doing it, right?
And I think that's a very important part. I consider interviewing to be an art. And if you're more concerned about the next question you're going to ask instead of listening to what the person is saying, you may miss an important point or something that they've said that could be a very important aspect of the story, yeah.
So how do you, when you get back to the studio with all the footage that you have, do you look through it all decide which to pick and then and then write the story, or do you kind of write the story and then look for?
No, I look at all the video and listen to all of the answers from the interviews that we've done and then structure my story around what I've listened to and seen, and what kind of pictures might, bring the story more alive, bring it alive from the standpoint of, you know, the natural sound of the crowd cheering at a football game, or a band coming down Main Street on a 4th of July parade. Those sounds add quite a bit to it.
Have you ever been in a situation where you say, this just isn't working? And don't do it?
I've lost count.
Also, when you view the video, does the story begin to change?
Yes. There are times, Don, when I've gone back and crossed things out and rearranged words. I could have said this, you know, using 3 words instead of 6 or 7. A lot of it is about efficiency, because most of these stories only run maybe 2 or 2.5 minutes. And I know to the public that doesn't sound like a lot of time, but you'd be amazed what you can tell in that amount of time, you know.
Yeah, you're talking to one who used to agonize over editing film
to
get it down. Or who has spent an entire night in his basement trying to get dissolves for a 1-minute film bit.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Time, so much goes into so little space sometimes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's not only true in doing television work, but in writing too. The whole process of editing is pruning away, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. The if you can say it in fewer words, that's the way you should say it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an interesting job you have, and you really ought to look around now and be sure where you have these scripts, because you may have something there that you could probably do a television feature and put some of these together. You might find a nice sequential thread through the right stories. But you could also write these too, Fran.
Mm-hmm. People have asked me if I'm interested in writing a book, and I'm still trying to decide how long I'm going to work. I just turned 65, so decision day is not too far away.
Well, you know, that's one of the great things in this life, Tweet and I are guilty of hanging on too long. But if the world is to move, we must step aside and let younger people do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep preaching that. I just don't practice it.
It is hard to do.
Yes.
It is. It's hard to quit working. It really is. What would you do if you didn't have these features to do?
That's what I'm still trying to decide. I think I'd do some volunteer work, especially through my church, and love being around people, though, Don. Quite honestly, that's one of the reasons why I'm not even giving retirement a consideration, because I love and I would miss tremendously the day-to-day contact with the type of people that I'm privileged enough to meet. You
that
know?
Is the common problem in this business.
Yes.
It's really hard to quit something that you truly enjoy. And I must say, friend, time put its hand on you very gently. If you didn't tell me you were 65 and I didn't know you've been around forever, I would not believe you. Well, Fran, keep going with Fran's features, because it's a delightful part of television.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to have been here, too.
Well, thank you for being here. And with that, we'll take a little break and go to the book bag. Well, positive news stories are a good thing, you know. Fran's features are enjoyable. Have you enjoyed anything between book covers lately?
Well, I enjoy not only positive stories, but negative ones. And it occurred to me when I knew we were going to have Fran on, and we need an antidote to all that enthusiasm and excitement and positivity, I thought of a short story, long short story, maybe a novella by Herman Melville called Bartleby the Scrivener, that would be perfect if you belong to a book discussion group that likes to debate things and that raises issues. Have you ever read Bartleby the Scrivener?
No, I know of it, but I've never read it.
Bartleby the Scrivener is about the narrator is a man who runs a law office that deals in fairly safe law, deeds, legal problems, not criminal law. He doesn't touch the courtroom. All he wants to do in life is be safe. Because it's before Xerox machines, he has to hire clerks who copy day after day legal deeds. It's not their own work. It's just a parody of what writing and communication is. And one day he hires a man called Bartleby, who appears at his office, and for a week or so, Bartleby does faithfully copy and then reads back to him to make sure that they haven't made any mistakes in a nice handwriting. But one day, Bartleby, when he's asked to copy this, says, "I would prefer not to." Well, that's not the answer a clerk is supposed to give, but it is an answer that makes sense. Who in his right mind wants to be a Xerox machine and copy day after day meaningless documents? Bartleby continues to say, "I would prefer not to," and stops working entirely, shows up for work. The narrator hides him behind a screen, and the narrator is now faced with a dilemma. He is both a lawyer and a Christian. He knows what's good for business, which is fire Bartleby. But his church tells him that he is his brother's keeper and that he owes Bartleby. It's clearly that something is bothering Bartleby. He's mentally ill. He's degenerating into an incredible gulf. So should he fire Bartleby, or should he turn the other cheek and be good to him and feed him and keep him on? He can't do both. And as a matter of fact, neither really works very well, right? Nothing that this man could do for Bartleby is going to help Bartleby's dissent. And I want to read, I'm doing this just because I want to read the last paragraph of this story.
Okay.
Because it turns out that where Bartleby came from to this law office is the dead letter office in Washington, D.C., where all the dead letters that can't be delivered end up and are burned in the flames. It's Bartleby's job to take these lacks of communication and burn them. Here's the last paragraph of the story. Believe me, your book club will get a great discussion out of this. Conceive a man by nature and misfortune prone to a pallid hopelessness. Can any business seem more fitted to heighten it than that of continually handling these dead letters and continually and assorting them for the flames? For by the cartload they are annually burned. Sometimes from out the folded paper the pale clerk takes a ring. The finger was meant for, perhaps, molders in the grave. A banknote sent in swiftest charity, he whom it would relieve nor eats nor hungers any more. Pardon for those who died despairing, hope for those who died on hoping, good tidings for those who died stifled by unrelieved calamities. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. Ah, Bartleby, ah, humanity.
Very good. Bartleby the Scrivener, that's one I've heard about that story.
It is worth reading. It is Melville's darker side. Moby Dick affirms life, but Melville wrote some other smaller things that don't.
Well, Melville wrote about the whaling industry in Moby Dick.
Well, he did, I know, but that turns out to be a triumph, right? Even though everybody in the thing is killed except the narrator. Nevertheless, it affirms life.
Mm-hmm.
But Melville wrote stories. The similar situation occurs in Billy Budd, where the chaplain, the Navy chaplain, is forced to realize that he represents the Prince of Peace, but he's on a naval vessel that goes out and kills people. Mm-hmm. To whom does he owe the most allegiance?
Yeah, Billy.
He wears the king's buttons, right?
Yeah, that's right. Billy Budd is a fascinating story. It's made into a wonderful opera, too, which I had the opportunity to see at the Lyric.
Yeah.
And at the ending, when he says, God bless Captain Beer,
right.
That's almost more than you can take.
Yeah, yeah.
How can he do that?
Yeah, in the real story, he does that, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by writers who can give you things like this. Who can make you think, present you with a conclusion that is not a conclusion,
right.
But is really a question.
Right. Well, and it's a question for all of us, right, to what do we owe to our fellow human creatures?
Yeah,
right?
That's true. Well, maybe we should start a Melville revival, although does he need revival?
He doesn't need a revival. He's on one of those 100 best-loved novels. Moby Dick is on there, and it should be.
Have they resolved that yet?
No, there's a program every week in which famous people push a certain book and it end by saying, I want you to vote for this book. And they're going through all 100. And then I think by the end of October, we will have picked the best loved novel in America. It's going to be interesting to see how that turns out.
I know what it should be, and we'll wait. That'll do it for now. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Whitman. Join us next week for the next edition of Scribble.